Small Supports in Time of Crisis is a podcast series made using extracts from a live webinar which was recorded in July 2020 and hosted by Bill Love from NDTI, in conversation with Small Supports providers Doreen Kelly from Beyond Limits, Sam Smith from Sea Change, and Dave Barris from Positive Support for You. For some people using social care support, the pandemic has meant a loss or threatened loss of rights, well-being, and safety. But it doesn't have to be this way. This series explores how individually designed and led community-based supports have worked to protect both people's health and human rights.
So you've created these services that have tried to think about people's rights and safety, and along comes COVID. What changes did you need to do when COVID appeared?
Interestingly, I think my answer to that question would be organisationally huge. Put policy, procedure, have meetings, think about government briefings, have your nose to the television to work out what's happening, to bring that into the organisation. But interestingly, in people's lives, not very much. So, of course, you had to put briefings out and you had to ask your teams to follow some of those. And you had to help people understand what these briefings meant or what the government meant or what the rules are or how to keep people safe. But that's probably what's going on in every other household up and down the country, I suspect. And one of the things that, I mean, I'm sure people would agree with this one. I mean, I was daily very, very upset by all the deaths in the country at the point where they were high. They're still too high, but there was a point where they were horrendous. And when we started coming through this, one of my horrors, one of the things I was terrified was that we lost people. We've got some people with some significant underlying health conditions, but we didn't. And then, you know, I know that could have been different, but I think we had less chance of doing so, of losing people we support, and to some extent of there being a spread because of the way the people live. So people live in their own homes now. They do have staff coming in and out, and some staff, you know, for an example, we had somebody we support who contracted COVID, and the member of staff on with her at the time just stayed there for 14 days. So the member of staff got it, she got it, and they came through it, but we were able to protect others. It wasn't like wildfire through a 10, 15, 20, 30, 3, 4, 5 person group home stroke, residential care home. So I think just the model itself, and it was striking to me, the model itself or the way of working with people in terms of protecting their human rights protected their health as well, and that really, really struck me. And I mean, I think it's the right way. I think it's right to treat people like human beings. I think it's right that people have the same rights as I do and the same rights to citizenship and everything. But actually, it's safer as well, which hadn't ever really dawned on me to, and safer in a health when we have contagion, it's safer, which it was quite striking for me, I'd have to say. But actually, people just did the same as the rest of society. If people had underlying health conditions, then they followed that guidance. If they didn't, they followed that guidance. And the only other thing that was important is that we could make different arrangements for each person, so people didn't have to adhere. So some people's families would have a different plan with the person they supported. Some people would turn up and see people in the garden, of course, when that was allowed. Some people would choose not to. So people didn't have to fit in, but things were fitted around them. And I think that was safe, but also morally right.
I'm really pleased, Doreen, to hear you say what I was thinking, really, because I've not really talked to anyone else about this, but exactly, in some respects, a very similar experience. We work very hard in the background around policy, risk assessments were written every day and twice on Sundays, I think. You know, sourcing PPE was initially a nightmare. All the usual that everyone else has heard all of that, but that's not unique. But we thankfully, and I'm touching wood as I say this still, because there's still the risk there. We didn't experience significant direct impact on the people we support or the staff around them. Although we had exactly the same experience, people were able to act very much as we, as everyone around us was acting, in terms of it was very much a home domestic sort of approach to it, in terms of building you know, a plan around each person in the, around their needs and around their presentation regarding their health, in terms of shielding and that sort of thing. We had contingency plans with families who were prepared to step in if those sorts of things around that person, and if necessary, move in with the person. So thankfully, we never needed to go to that level of that level of crisis. So we've been very lucky in some respects. But part of it's not luck. Part of it's about the model itself is quite self-sustaining in that sense, because if you get a good team of people, we have some good people who are really focused around each person that they're working with, have a strong relationship with them and their families, then these conversations are easier, the protection around the person was easier. And the only other thing was that some of the digital discrimination that many of the people we work with suffer has challenged us, and we've had to do better. So we've had people who've never used social media before using WhatsApp to speak to mum 3 times a day, and that's done us good as well, really, just to remind us to think a little bit more laterally in those sorts of areas. So, you know, we've had a range of different experiences for all the different people we support, but thankfully that's worked really well for us.
What I'm hearing is that the response, whereas nationally there was a lot of conversation about how should care homes respond and waiting for guidance, but what Doreen and Dave are saying is we didn't respond as a care home, we responded as a person in their own home.
Organisationally, lots of work to do, helping people understand the guidance, as Doreen said, but actually it was the teams and families who came up with the arrangements that made sense. So if families were shielding, different arrangements there, and as Dave said, making sure that people kept contact through Zoom or Teams or whatever made sense to them. Nobody had their support reduced. Now, this has happened notably in some areas in Scotland, and particularly around home care. Nobody had their support reduced. It changed because we had to consider that actually direct support could in and of itself be a risk. The other thing I need to comment on is, again, taking the opportunity to reflect and consider how individuals themselves responded to this pandemic. And sometimes you've got to challenge yourself about the mental restrictions you might have. I mean, I used a brief story in one of the blogs that I wrote about a man that we support who is autistic. And at one point had this kind of massive reputation where they designed services around him that he managed to dismantle. And he managed to go with a trusted team member to go and get tested. And it was, you know, not a problem because he was supported by people who know him, supported well in a way that he could understand. So there's been opportunities to be humbled by families, our colleagues, and the people that we work for, and similar to Doreen and Dave, and touching wood, we've had no confirmed cases of COVID.
Listening to you, Sam, and also listening to Doreen and Dave, I'm picking up that what you're saying is actually at a time when most people were centralising control, you as small supports organisations have actually used this as an opportunity for the individual, the family around them and their support team to make more of the decisions and have more of the control.
Well, it's a core principle in our organisation, and I'm sure with Dave and Doreen, that decision making sits with or as close to the person as possible. And that's for all things in people's lives. We have to be constantly aware if we are sucking up control, making decisions. It really has to be at all times supporting the individual or those who know and care about them to to lead with those decisions?
Well, I think I would further say on that one, Bill, it wouldn't actually be possible in my organisation for me to take power and control, because actually it's just not the norm. It's not acceptable. People we support are king, and families we support are queen. And that sounds a little bit daft, but I think it sets the right tone. And actually, it's not. I wouldn't be allowed to do it, and I'm proud of that.
I'd agree. I'm the last person who could possibly, or should be having those conversations with people, because I wouldn't know. In terms, I know people, and I know them to a degree, but I certainly on a day-to-day basis, it's nothing to do with me. And it's down to day-to-day decisions for people and the people who are there to support them, to help them and enable them to do that. The only other reflection I'd offer is, I think we worked really hard, and I'm sure Doreen and Sam did as well, in terms of we've got good people who work in our organisation. But I think there was a great deal of fear created around people who are working in frontline positions like our staff. So one area where I was involved and senior manager is we a lot of visible support and help and just being there for staff and enabling staff to get on and do those things around the people at their end. So I think that was how it works. There was more of that going on, and a lot of organisations will have done that in all settings, I'm sure. But that felt like a big part of what we were doing as well.
I think just the only other thing I'd add on that is that when people were left to their own devices, so we've got some people who'll, I call it their nightclub. Accident and emergency can be their nightclub, because that's their go-to place in the middle of the night when they self-harm or drink too much or take drugs or whatever. And I actually saw people really settling down, and really some of that might have been because there was less activity generally. But I think the people we support really got it and really, really played their part. And that includes people who have got some of the biggest reputations for being, the most complicated people to support, if you like. And I saw a real ability for people to make their own decisions and to make good decisions. I see that anyway, but I saw it more.
The other thing is, I think people, it's just an observation, really. I think the fact that the restrictions were applied there to everybody across society, whereas many of the people we work with and for have had many restrictions applied to them. And they see other people not having restrictions. So in some respects, I think people were quite comfortable seeing, they felt part of the whole more in a strange sort of way. And that seemed to have a positive effect on their ability to fit in with restrictions that were, that were sometimes a pain to them, because they couldn't go out or they couldn't go and do the things they used to do, and there's certainly the people we supported have become more outward looking in terms of seeing what's going on around them in that sense, because there's more interest, I think. They feel more part of that. So there's a slightly odd positive in there, I guess.
Thank you for listening. For more information about NDTI's Small Supports programme, follow the link in the podcast description or visit ndti.org.uk.